Maritime Matters, global perspectives through a German lens for the maritime industry. We bring the German perspective to the world and global insights to Germany. Maritime Matters is produced by the German Maritime Center, the think tank for the German maritime sector.
Welcome to our podcast. My name is Matthias Katon. I'm the managing director of the German Maritime Center and your host. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Jaap Gebraert to Maritime Matters. Jaap brings a wealth of experience to our discussion. He has for over a decade served as the board secretary and senior project manager at the Foundation STC Group and as a daily secretary of the European Association EDINA. From 2018 to 2022, he was also the director of research and development at SEA Europe and the executive director of the Waterborne Technology Platform. And since then, he has been the secretary general of that organization, and we'll talk more about it in a second. He holds a bachelor's degree in logistics and economics from the University of Applied Sciences in Rotterdam, and he is a true expert with a lot of insight into the European waterborne sector. And that is our topic. We will talk about Europe. We will talk about strategies. We'll talk about research, development, and innovation on the European scale for the maritime sector. Let's kick things off by giving our listeners an idea of what the Waterborne Technology Platform actually is, why it was created, and what kind of work you're doing.
First of all, many thanks for inviting me for this podcast. Maybe a couple of things to start with, because you already referred to the word waterborne, which is not always easily translatable into national languages. So why is it called waterborne? Because it includes both the maritime angle, but also the inland navigation angle of the sector. And then in some languages, maritime does not include the inland navigation angle. So for that reason, it's called the Waterborne Technology Platform. We are one of the technology platforms on a European level, recognized by the European Commission, but not financed by the European Commission. And our main goal is to provide guidance on what are the research and innovation priorities of our sector, which represents the entire waterborne ecosystem. So shipyards, equipment manufacturers, ship owners, maritime and inland navigation, ports, infrastructure providers, the research community. So I would say the full waterborne ecosystem. Next to providing policy guidance to the European institutions, we have a partnership with the European Commission since 2021, which is called the Zero Emission Waterborne Transport Partnership, where we jointly define a roadmap towards zero emission solutions with a budget of, from the public side, 530 million euros, which is then being tendered via the research and innovation program of the European Commission called Horizon Europe. So that is a bit of a snapshot of what is waterborne, what do we do, and where are some terminologies coming from?
Yeah, thanks for that. And obviously, that is one of the challenges that we have in Europe, is that we have so many languages. And sometimes when you translate things, some nuances are lost or some things are simply not translatable. So I guess that might have been a challenge finding that name. And now you have to do a lot of explaining when you talk to people. So you have a very diverse set of members. For example, the German Maritime Center, the institution that runs and hosts this podcast, is one of the members. But you also have many companies who are members of that, European companies, but I understand also some non-European companies. So from a business perspective, how does the platform facilitate collaboration and knowledge sharing among especially such a diverse group of members with so many different interests?
We have around 130 members. Half of the membership is directly industry or industry representatives. And there again, sometimes different definitions of industry are there, but let's say the sector private side. And half of the membership is the research and academia. The members originate from 19 EU member states and 4 countries on the European continent, but not member of the EU. So the EEA countries. Members have to be based in the EU. However, a lot of our private members and also some public members, of course, have activities outside Europe. Some are highly international, some are very regional or local. There are, I think, two layers. One is the diversified sector. And even within certain segments like equipment manufacturers, you have a very big diversification from very small companies up to the multinationals. And then 23 different cultures on board. So that is indeed a very interesting arena. What we basically do is having a very much bottom-up approach. So jointly, we set a long-term strategy. Jointly, we set a research agenda. And jointly from this research agenda, we try to come to a priority in research and innovation needs. Of course, always taking into account, because in the end, it's EU budget, which is then being dispersed, taking into account the EU political priorities. For us, it's very important that we invest sufficient time in being able to do this bottom-up approach, to listen to everybody's input, to listen to everybody's individual, sometimes challenges, individual on a company level or individual on a segment level, to see, okay, how can we come to a coordinated approach towards research and innovation? Recently, the European Commission published an interim report on the Zero Emission Waterborne Transport Partnership. And one of the main findings in that report was the fact that we were able, as such a diversified sector, to come to a coordinated strategic research and innovation agenda. So it is possible, but it requires quite some time. Shall we put it like this?
That's a very diplomatic answer. Of course, I think it's quite obvious that there must be conflicts of interest between the different parties. So I guess that's a very tedious process, but all the better that you were able to manage that. Now, you said initially that Waterborne is a very closely associated entity with the European Union, but it's not financed by the European Union. How is your interaction with EU policymakers and with the EU institutions? How do you work with them on a day-to-day basis?
There are two levels, and I think it's almost the same as at national level. We often refer to the European Commission, but there is no European Commission because I think there are 25 commission services, as we call it, so 25 ministries. Just to give an example, the Partnership on Zero Emission Waterborne Transport, the MOU was signed by the Ministry of Research, the Ministry of Transport, and the Ministry of Climate. Already that in itself shows that also on the side of the European Commission, there might be different priorities depending on which policies are these commission services working on. We have a very close relationship at working level. So we, on our side, jointly define research priorities, but we also consult with the European Commission services on our key documents to see, okay, how do we integrate in our storyline the main policies of the European Commission. And also on their side, there is a principle of co-creation where sometimes we are in a meeting together with 10 European Commission services to see, okay, how do we come from all of these documents to an aligned storyline which links with all the policies going on at the European level. One, I think, very good example is we have every 2 years a big event, which is called Waterborne Days. We also there jointly set the agenda. So we have every 2-3 weeks a meeting with the different European Commission services to see, okay, how can we jointly shape this agenda? Of course, in the end, for the future of the European waterborne sector. But for us, public and private stakeholders play an equal role in setting the next steps in terms of research, development, and innovation.
I want to talk a bit more about the EU and the EU's agenda. But before we do that, some of our listeners, maybe with companies, maybe with other organizations, who now say, well, we're not part of Waterborne yet, but this sounds interesting. We would like to become involved. What is the procedure for that?
There we are far less bureaucratic, if I may call it like this. Any company in Europe, any organization in Europe, which is active in the waterborne sector, can apply for membership. Now, maybe what is good to explain, because that I didn't do in the beginning, we have three technical working groups where we do the bottom-up approach. One is on ships and shipping, so everything which has got to do with both the sailing part as well as with the production of ships and equipment. The second one is on ports and logistics. So not only greening and digitalizing the port operations, and in our most recent document also ports as energy hubs, but equally important, the integration of maritime transport in the logistics chain. So that is a bit the concepts we are discussing there. And we have a revamped Blue Economy Working Group. Now, Blue Economy is, again, I think, a buzzword everywhere, and it has different definitions. What we did in the last couple of months is bring our Blue Economy as close as possible to our industrial base. So where do European shipyards and equipment manufacturers play a role in the Blue Economy? There are three key areas there. Ships which are not traditional transport ships, but which are linked to blue economy sectors, so fishing vessels, vessels supporting aquaculture, etc. Infrastructure at sea, for example, the development of offshore wind platforms. And the third one is the underwater domain, for example, with underwater unmanned vehicles and underwater drones. Now, any company or organization which has activities in these three domains can become a member of the waterborne technology platform as long as the company is based in the EU or on the European continent.
Our podcast is called Maritime Matters, but the subtitle is Global Perspectives Through a German Lens. So let me ask you about German participation. Are you generally happy with the involvement of German companies, the German business in waterborne? Or would you say, compared to other countries, are there still gaps that you'd like to see filled?
We have 130 members, and half of them originate from six or seven member states, and Germany is amongst these six or seven member states. So as such, I would say Germany has a fairly good representation in the platform. Where further interactions or membership, or however we call it, with some sectors might still be helpful. So we see that in the ports domain, we still need to work a bit on how do we further enhance dialogue with the port sector. Would say the same counts for ship owners if we look at our total list. And then, since this is a fairly revamped activity, blue economy, we need to see, okay, how do we get from the sector itself, how do we get into the research priorities? So in terms of numbers, I would say Germany is among the top five. In terms of sector representatives, we still need to see, okay, how do we balance a bit more within our platform?
Talking about numbers, we have two fixed segments in our podcast, and one of them is called
Nautical Numbers.
So what would your nautical number be?
The European Commission is investing 530 million in this partnership via Horizon Europe. It is expected that the private side of this, as it is called in these partnerships, is investing in additional activities. So things that the sector is doing by itself, but contribute to reaching these objectives. Often our sector is being referred to as conservative. I'm not sure if I fully agree with that one. I would say it's introvert, because what turns out is that the sector at the same moment in time, and we do that mapping on a yearly basis, so it's our members and the members of our members sometimes, invests 3.3 billion at the same moment in time in activities related to zero emission waterborne transport, which is a leverage of 6, which is the biggest leverage in Horizon Europe if you compare it to all the other sectors having a partnership. So I thought, okay, this is for me one of the most interesting nautical numbers to mention, and let's see how we all can improve a bit our communication on what we are doing, because we are not that conservative as people think. We might communicate a bit more.
That is very interesting, and I have to admit, I was not aware of that either, so that communication got lost. But you're absolutely right. You don't just need to do good things, you also have to talk about it. So thank you very much for sharing this very, very interesting nautical number. Let's talk a little bit about the EU. So the EU has what I think is officially called Research and Development and Innovation, a policy framework for not just waterborne issues, of course. Tell us, what are the key funding mechanisms when we talk about the maritime sector under this R&D&I umbrella?
There are three currently, I would say. One is Horizon Europe, which is the research, development and innovation program of the European Commission, in the past called framework programs. The budget of Horizon Europe is around 96 billion for 7 years, ending in 2027. So 7 years, 27 member states, all sectors in Europe. And within that total, 800, 850 million has been earmarked for waterborne applications. If you would look at R&I spendings in defense, it's far more than the 800 million euro. What we also have a look at is, A, often our research development and innovation, or the research development and innovation in the partnership, is at a high tier level. So what does it mean? A technology is being developed and tested on board. Some are at lower level, testing at labs, but a lot is being done in terms of how can we later on deploy these technologies as soon as possible. So we look at, okay, we have the innovation, which funding instruments could be available to start implementing these innovations in the market. There are two interesting ones there. One is Connecting Europe Facility, which is mainly looking at infrastructure. Not only infrastructure in terms of roads, but also infrastructure in ports, bunkering infrastructure, and sometimes a link with vessels. So if you are in a chicken and egg situation, we could get the fuel and the fuel infrastructure, but we don't have the off-takers, or you have the off-takers, but you don't have the fuel and the fuel infrastructure. There is a combination possible within the Connecting Europe Facility. And the second one is the EU Innovation Fund, which is funding first of its kind's deployment on lowering emissions, funded by the EU ETS, a relatively new instrument. What is specifically interesting in the Innovation Fund is that it is also funding operational expenses, and I think it's 60% of additional operational expenses for a period of 10 years. Now, the only challenge we have, of course, we have more than one challenge, but a big challenge we have, and we are looking internally how to be able to get this further forward, is applying for these funds can be complicated. So big companies in general have found their way on how to apply in all of these funding instruments. Majority of the sector is a small and medium-sized enterprise. So how can we help small and medium-sized enterprises finding their way in funding mechanisms, but also that requires that these funding mechanisms become a bit more easy to access? Think that at the level of the European Commission, there is an awareness and a willingness to do something, but it would be good if all of us come forward with concrete ideas on how could it be done. Looking a bit further ahead, the European Commission published their budget proposal for the period 2024. Within all the documents, there is a lot of emphasis on getting easy access to funding for small and medium-sized enterprises. But once again, I think it would be a joint effort to see, okay, how can we facilitate more easy access to funding for SMEs?
Yeah, I guess it's easier said than done, probably. But is that really true? Because I think that's a widely held belief among many players, I believe in Germany, but probably also elsewhere, is that European funds are on the one side quite attractive because there's often also more money in it than, for example, in national programs that may exist. But at the same time, there's also this fear that it's, you know, absolutely burdensome, just the application process. Then once you even get into it, the reporting requirements. Is that true, or is it also a bit of a myth that gets perpetuated?
There is nothing like free money. So it's always finding somewhere the balance between how can you make it as easily accessible and how do you still comply with all the transparency rules. It's just an example. There are two elements. Most of the funding instruments you have to apply for in a consortia. And for a small and medium-sized enterprise, the best thing to do would be to join with one or two bigger companies who can basically guide you in that process, and where you as a smaller company would only be responsible for getting the content in, and all the administrative part is done by the coordinator. Still lengthy process, but doable if you can team up with a couple of bigger players or with universities, whoever is already experienced in the domain. A lot has been done on the reporting part. The financial reporting is far less burdensome than it was in the past. There is a tendency now to go towards lump sum financing. So you get a certain budget to achieve a certain objective. When the objective has been achieved, the money is being paid. So that is already a significant step forward, I would say, in terms of timesheets, all kind of very detailed financial reports with checks of accountants. That part is already significantly being simplified. And I see in the proposal for the next 7 years that the tests they have been doing, they would like to further implement in the next budgetary period.
So the glass is half full from your perspective.
I don't say it's easy, but we have to see all of us, how can we facilitate it?
So that's encouraging even for smaller, medium-sized companies who may have been afraid of getting into that field. So yeah, what you're saying is don't be too afraid. Maybe look for partners, companies that are bigger, universities, some experienced players for your first steps into that area. You mentioned, and I hope I got this right, when you talked about the Horizon program, $96 billion over 10 years, out of that $850 million earmarked for maritime or waterborne. So that's less than 1%. Here in Germany, players from the maritime sector often complain, probably rightly so, that compared to other infrastructure projects or other infrastructure areas, such as railway, for example, or road-based transportation, the maritime sector gets the smallest size of investments. When I hear those numbers from the European level, I would say the same thing happens on the European level as well. Is that true? Are you happy with the amount of funding? I mean, obviously, from your perspective, it could always be more, I suppose. But do you think that is fair, given the breadth of responsibilities that the European Union has? Or do you think that the maritime sector is strategically underfunded also on the European level when you talk about these projects?
You know, I have a Dutch passport, so if you speak about money, then it's never enough. Let's put two elements. The amount of funding available in Horizon Europe, which is for 7 years, doubled compared to the previous period. So in that sense, the glass is half full. Of course, if we look at the fact that the sector is investing six times more, that implies that A, the challenges are huge in terms of at least financial burden. B, what also turns out is that we are absolutely not there yet. If we look at zero emission, lower power requirements, lower autonomy in terms of sailing time, we are getting to deployable solutions. But the higher power requirements, the longer autonomy, the more complicated it gets. What I always find complicated is that, can we compare ourselves with other transport modes? Because sometimes we compare ourselves when it makes sense or when it is in our favor, but when it's not in our favor, we don't want to compare ourselves because we are so unique. There we might also have partially the stumbling block. The rail sector is one. The aviation sector is almost one. I mean, we have the big aviation industrial companies in Europe is one. The airlines are quite united. The car industry, although different countries have their own brands, is steering in that direction because there it's mainly focused on the production part, of course. In our case, the sector is quite diversified. So where I think there is still room for improvement to potentially be able to get a bigger budget, and that depends a bit. I don't know what is happening in Germany. In other countries, we see a tendency shifting in a certain direction. But if we all knock on the doors individually as segments of the waterborne sector, or we go with a united voice towards policymakers, that might make a big difference. That's one. What is also very helpful, and I saw it in the budgetary proposal for Horizon Europe, is this is what we want to achieve, have a clear objective. This is what we will invest as a sector. This is where the gap is. That is also nowadays becoming a more easily negotiation position. But once again, I'm not fully aware of what is happening in Germany, but I see that that is working on a European level. Now, the sector as such, and maybe we come back to it a bit more in detail, has never been higher on the political agenda as it currently is on a European level. But I think also at national levels, we see more and more national strategies being rolled out. When I looked at the proposal for the budget of the EU for the next 7 years, for sure there will be a budget, and for sure the budget will be significantly increased compared to the past. Will it be equal or higher than other modes of transport? We have to see. But as you say, there is also, of course, a lot of investments in infrastructure in other sectors, which may already, where we have different types of infrastructures and different ownership. So that might also dilute the picture a bit in terms of comparing numbers.
You said the industry has never been higher on the agenda as it currently is. I guess at least part of the explanation is for geopolitical and security issues. Is that true, or are there other factors that play into that as well?
I think the starting point was the COVID crisis. When airplanes were grounded for a couple of weeks, if I recall correctly, and supplies were still coming in. And then people started to wonder, where are my supplies coming from? That was the turning point. And it sounds rather strange, but apparently this is how it works. That was the turning point, of course, then followed by security situations, including the fact that for gas imports in Europe, we are highly dependent currently on shipping. That has indeed led to a big picture of this sector will be key for security, for strategic autonomy, for food, for energy, etc. So absolutely, a couple of developments have led to recognizing the strategic importance of waterborne ecosystem, waterborne sector, maritime sector, depending a bit on how it's being framed at national level.
So it might also be an issue with lack of visibility, also compared to other transport modes, because most of us, also most politicians, most decision makers, we go by train, we drive on the streets, we fly, but most people don't take a ship on a regular basis from A to B. So is that also something that the sector is just not visible unless you happen to live next to a port where you see ships going in and out every day?
Then we come back to the part of being introvert at the beginning. Absolutely, that's one part of the story. We had the second edition of the Waterborne Days in February this year, where we started the event with a 4-minute movie made by one of the ship-owning organizations in Europe, The World Without Shipping. And that movie has been made in a very good way in terms of, you see after a couple of days, food not being available in supermarkets. A couple of days later, you see that medication is becoming scarce. A month later or 3 weeks later, you see airplanes are being grounded because we are in the end transporting the kerosene to let the airplanes fly. So that is indeed something which we sometimes could communicate more. What is also a difference with other modes of transport as I see it, and I think also here again, we are making a big leap compared to a couple of years ago, but CEOs of these very big multinationals simply knock the doors of some policymakers. I can do a lot of work in Brussels, but in the end, it needs to be the company sometimes at high level, if we like it or not, that need to knock the door to get a meeting.
Another fixed segment that we have that is slightly more lighthearted, but equally important is
Navigator's Table.
And we ask our guests to recommend one place, a restaurant, a bar, whatever it may be, that is either located in a port or on the seashores or has some kind of a maritime connection to it. So I'm very curious to hear what recommendation you can give our listeners. Where should they go?
With this type of work, you travel a lot, which is less exotic than people think, but there are two advantages. One, the different people you meet in different cultures. And secondly, sometimes you discover a hidden gem when you are invited for dinner. There is a fish restaurant in the bay in Piraeus, which is called Farulco Seaside, which is the biggest. I would have never discovered it if it would not be linked to a business meeting. So it's the environment, it's the look at the ocean, and it was the food. That combination was splendid. Piraeus is known to be a port area, but it also has some hidden gems in terms of beauty of the nature within that region. So I would say if anybody is ever in Athens, that would absolutely be a recommendation.
We'll try to find the address and maybe some link that we can put in the show notes so that people can find it next time they head to Piraeus. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Jaap, for this recommendation. And whenever I'm there next time, I will make sure to try it out. So we talked a lot about Waterborne, obviously, as a platform. We talked about the EU and its policies and how to access that. But of course, there are certain focus areas that the EU wants to focus on that are also universally recognized as being important drivers of future progress. You mentioned one, so maybe we could start with that, which is the move towards zero emission in the shipping industry. most of our listeners will be familiar. There are the IMO goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2050 as kind of the most important international goal. And there's a lot of discussion going on right now how to achieve that. And one or a lot of the discussions always center around alternative fuels. And there are many options. Most of us know them. But whenever I go to meetings, it seems that we're always having the same discussion. We're discussing the pros and cons of the different fuel or the different methods. And at least as far as I am concerned, I have the impression that we're in a bit of a chicken and an egg situation, because the ship owners seem to be waiting for one technology, or at least a dominant technology, to emerge before they place appropriate orders in new ships. And likewise, those operators who have to provide the infrastructure are waiting for the same thing, right? They are saying, before we invest in a lot of costly infrastructure on shore, we need to see which of the technologies is going to go forward. How can we get out of this chicken and egg situation? And what role can maybe public money, funds by the European Union and others, help break through this inertia or this chicken and egg situation?
Maybe as a matter of clarification, so in our definition, zero emission is fully eliminating greenhouse gas emissions, but also cutting pollution to air and eliminating pollution to water. So there the challenge is, I would say, even bigger than solemnly the greenhouse gas emission reduction. There are maybe a couple of things which can be considered. Because for me, there is no maritime sector. There are different segments and different business models and trades which we need to take into account. So in our work, open for any different categorization, we said, okay, we have 110,000 IMO classified vessels. We have 12,000 inland navigation vessels. They need to be zero emission by 2050. They also need to cut emissions by 55% by 2030, which is basically yesterday. So how can we classify the worldwide fleet into a couple of different ship types? In our case, looking at power requirements and autonomy in terms of how long can you sail without bunkering, we came to six, starting with inland navigation, then ferries as a separate concept. Short sea shipping in the EU definition of sailing between two EU ports or an EU port and a neighboring country. Cruise ships, specifically also for the fact that this is a unique European product. Intercontinental shipping and a category of offshore. That's one. So could we have a look at possible pathways for different ship types? Because we will not have one pathway for the entire maritime sector. Of course, where it becomes even more complicated is we will need different solutions for liner shipping and for tram shipping. Where I think public money can make a big difference, at least in creating a snowball of supply of fuels and offtake of fuels, plus potentially retrofitting or new building vessels, so also contributing to industrial competitiveness, is a systematic approach towards deployment. So often we see there is a funding scheme. One vessel can be built or can be retrofitted to sail on a certain fuel. There should be a possibility to pool resources and to have a look at, okay, we are going to look at the fuel supply for a certain segment of shipping for certain routes. We are going to look at the infrastructure, plus at building or retrofitting these ships. That leads, at least on these routes, to already cutting emissions significantly. It also implies that fuels will become available in more ports, so other ships, ship types and trades might start to use these ports in terms of bunkering. So there you get a kind of a snowball in pooling resources. It is a thought which is currently being discussed. It might not fully work for all segments, it might not fully work for all trades, but absolutely something to be looked into. A second angle, which is coming back more and more, is can we jointly do on a European level something to green the total ferry fleet in Europe? 4,000 ferries, most of them quite old. There is a need to retrofit or renew. How can we there again pull public and private resources to renew that European ferry fleet, which would have a big potential again for industrial competitiveness? So still to be looked at in the detail, but the European Commission has published what they call a European Competitiveness Fund. Basically, grouping, I think, 14 former EU programs into one toolbox. And that might lead to this kind of pooling of resources towards bigger initiatives.
Very valid point. Of course, there is no one-size-fits-all solution because it's too diverse, which again, we talked about the need to talk maybe with a more unified voice at times. But of course, that is complicated by the fact that the needs and the interests of the players are then all so different and the solutions that they require. So that's a bit of a conundrum, I might say.
Yeah.
But we will have to somehow manage that. Another issue that you also mentioned, I think earlier, which I believe is quite important, is digitization and automation in the maritime sector. What's your take there? What are the challenges there?
We had a working group on digitalization last year. We were finally able to come to a joint definition of digitalization because I think that's also one of the issues. What do we now define as digitalization? And is digitalization an objective or a means? I think on our side, we were quite aligned on its being a means and it's not the objective. There, again, it's very broad. From vessels sailing with lesser crew members because of the fact that any labor market at the moment is suffering from influx of people, but we need to keep the ship sailing. We are not speaking about unmanned ships because that's for us a different avenue, to using the potential of digitalization in shipbuilding and equipment manufacturing production. There again, lesser people available on the labor market, but we need to be able to produce. Third avenue, of course, is the integration in the logistics chain where digitalization plays a key role. It plays a key role in safety, security, energy efficiency, etc. What I see is that where that has not been possible in the past 7 years, in one of the upcoming strategies, it's called either the Industrial Maritime Strategy at European level or the Port Strategy at European level. In both, innovation will be a component of the strategy. And in one, it has been called innovation and digitalization, just to ensure that digitalization will be fully included in the innovation package. A couple of things, but that goes beyond our mandate. Harmonized languages, which we are going to use, harmonized frameworks, cybersecurity. How are we going to make it economically viable? Because it's not always economically viable yet. So there are quite a number of things to be looked at beyond R&D, but it is helpful, I think, that we are all, and I see different discussions slowly converging towards similar definitions of digitalization and the potential it could play in the sector. Let's take another example, data sharing. I have no idea how we are going to get an agreement on data sharing and data ownership to a certain extent. But it has a huge potential. So,
is that something that you would say is a particular challenge for the maritime sector, or would you say those are issues that are kind of universal? They apply to other business areas as well?
They apply to other business areas as well. I think in the transport domain, there are some examples which potentially could be used. But again, as we just said, these sectors are so different in terms of players and in terms of how they are all interlinked. But at least the good side of the coin is, I think, that on a European level, but I also see it on a national level, there is more and more awareness to fully use the potential of digitalization for the sector.
We're already slowly moving towards the end of this episode, so I would like to open it up and look a little bit into the future. I know that's always difficult, but if I ask you, what do you think will be the single most important factor that will determine success or failure of the European waterborne transport sector in the coming decades? What would you say? What is that?
That's an interesting one. Are we looking at research, development and innovation, or are we looking in general, how will the sector evolve on the European level?
That's up to you. I guess both are probably connected in one way or another, especially through work such as the one of your organization. I'll leave that up to you.
In terms of research, development and innovation, the key item will be, how will the EU budget look from 2028 to 2034? Of course, we had if you are involved in a daily basis, it was not a big surprise, but I think some people got a surprise this week with amounts that were floating around in terms of EU budget and some kind of calculations, which were maybe not always helpful. I think the budget and the budget of the EU in total will be one of the question marks. And I hope we have now been able to do this throughout, I think, three crises in a row, that we will keep the union together. But that all depends on factors which go way beyond what you and I are doing. But I think we will not be able to do this on our own. We need the sector as an ecosystem. But also, if we would go back to national ways of trying to arrange this sector, I don't think it will be very helpful. Certainly not if we then start to compare ourselves with other continents, which are most of the time, or other countries even, the size of the total European Union jointly together. So cooperation, I would say, is the key word.
Yeah, indeed, you're right. That goes beyond the mandate of both your and my organization. So we're just a tiny part of the whole thing. But I guess you're right. I agree with you that if we manage to do that, and I'm fairly optimistic that at the end of the day we will, I think Europe still has its best days ahead of it, despite all the people who say that we've lost, we're too complacent, we're yesterday, and other regions will start dominating. I think Europe should not be written off.
No.
I guess you agree. Yeah, that was a very, very interesting episode. We covered a lot of terrain. The industry is very broad. European funding projects and initiatives are also very broad. Bringing that all together is not easy. Explaining it is even less so. But I think what you personally and also the Water One platform are doing is a magnificent job. So thank you very much for taking the time for this interview. I think our listeners will have learned a lot of new information that they may be able to put into action either within Waterborne or somewhere else, be that as it may. We're a proud member of the organization, and I also look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for inviting and for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you learned something new. If you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. And don't forget to check out the show notes and more information about the German Maritime Center at maritimematters.de.